This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. David Johansen is a founding member of the New York Dolls, a legendary 1970s band that never sold many records but paved the way for punk rock. He's also performed in his persona Buster Poindexter, a pompadour-wearing lounge lizard. And he's played the blues with his band David Johansen and the Harry Smiths. Johansen is the subject of a new Showtime documentary, co-directed by Martin Scorsese and David Tedeschi, called Personality Crisis, One Night Only. Much of the documentary is built around Johansen's 2020 performance at the Cafe Carlyle in New York City as Buster Poindexter. It also includes new and archival interviews with him and others. Here's a clip from the documentary with the English singer and songwriter Morrissey. He says he was obsessed with the New York Dolls as a teenager because they brought a sense of danger to rock. Their music was loud and rough, but more than that.
So here were boys who were calling themselves dolls, and they looked like prostitutes, male prostitutes, which at the time, you have to remember, it was a long time ago, and all of that kind of thing was really taboo.
English singer Morrissey from the new Showtime documentary about the New York Dolls. Terry Gross spoke to David Johansen in 2004. The surviving members of the band had just reunited at the request of Morrissey for a festival in England. Their performance was recorded on a CD and DVD called The Return of the New York Dolls, live from Royal Festival Hall. The interview starts with a track from the album called Looking for a Kiss. The Dolls used to play this one in the 70s. It was written by David Johansen, who also sings lead.
When I say I'm in love, you best believe I'm in love, L.U.V. Looking for a kiss.
So when you were on stage, you know, with the reunited and the new version of the Dolls, and you were doing the old Doll songs, did you have any, like, flashbacks to things that you had totally forgotten about? Like, did memories, like, surface of things that were really interesting that you had completely forgotten about until you were back in that setting again?
Well, I have memories, but God, they're vague, you know. I mean, I remember the first time we made a record with Todd Rundgren, and the only thing I remember is the lights on the control board. I thought they were really pretty.
Mm.
And that's really the only memory I have.
Any historian would want to know all about that.
Of making that first record. That's the, you know, people think I'm kidding when they ask, well, what was it like making that first record? Because it, you know, kind of became this benchmark kind of record.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's really the only memory I have of it. But, you know, the thing that struck me was I had to kind of sit down and listen to the music and write the words down and learn them. And
oh, you had to relearn your own songs?
Yeah, because, you know, I hadn't sung them mm-hmm. in God knows how long, you know. I mean, it wasn't like I had to relearn them from scratch because they kind of come back to you, but I had to have some kind of thing to look at. And, you know, I find that when I write something, it goes into my head better than if I mm-hmm. just try to memorize it. So I was writing, for example, like Human Being, and I was thinking, God, how did I write that song? This is great. I mean, it really holds up, you know. It's kind of like a declaration that I think is timeless. So there's a lot of stuff like that in the songs, which... Let me explain something to you. There was a time, you know, when we started the Dolls and we were really such a gang, and it was like us against the world, and we were really trying to evolve music into something new, and it was, you know, very kind of almost militant to us. And then over the years, you know, in the history books, you know, like the Rolling Stone complete encyclopedia of rock and roll or something, you know, you look in the appendix and see where your name is and see what they say about you. It's not like you buy the book. And they would always say, you know, they were trashy, they were flashy, they were drug addicts, they were drag queens, you know. And that whole kind of trashy blah, blah, blah thing, I think over the years kind of settled in my mind as, oh yeah, that's what it was, you know. And then by going back to it and deconstructing it and then putting it back together again, I realized that, you know, it really is art, and that some critic at one time had come up with this catch-all phrase that, as you know, once somebody says it, then everybody just looks it up and they say it because nobody does.
Right.
Nobody has an original idea.
In spite of the fact that you don't remember a whole lot about parts of the early days of the Dolls, do you remember writing the song Personality Crisis?
Well, you know, I don't remember exactly sitting down and writing the words, but I remember where I got the name, because I was kind of like an acolyte in Charles Ludlam's Ridiculous Theater when I was a kid. This is when I was, you know, 17, 18, 19. And
let's just describe what Charles Ludlam's theater was. He used to dress and drag a lot as the leading lady and these like Greta Garbo kind of roles. And
yeah, but it was so much more than that. It was really very intelligent stuff that he used to do. And he used to combine a lot of genres you know, classical playwriting and, you know, like Moliere, he would put in with something kitschy that was present, you know, present day stuff. And he would make this melange of ideas that were just so, they would come out so original and brilliant that, you know, people throw the word genius around, but he was actually a genius. He was one of the most intelligent people I think I've ever met. But I think one day we were at a rehearsal or something, and he just said, oh, God, I'm having a personality crisis. And I just thought, oh, that's really good. And I wrote it down, you know, personality crisis. And that's really all I remember about writing a song, and the song came from that.
Well, why don't we hear Personality Crisis as performed by the New York Dolls at the Meltdown Festival over the summer. So this is from The Return of the New York Dolls.
That's the New York Dolls. We're listening to Terry's 2004 interview with David Johansen, who co-founded the band in the 1970s. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. It's easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself too thin. Therapy can provide the tools and self-awareness to help you learn how to recharge, define your boundaries, and build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp Online Therapy. fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with David Johansen, who co-founded the band The New York Dolls. They spoke when the band reunited for a festival in England. Their performance was recorded on a CD and DVD called The Return of the New York Dolls, live from Royal Festival Hall. Johansen is the subject of a new documentary on Showtime, co-directed by Martin Scorsese.
In the liner notes for the DVD and the CD, you write about Arthur Kane. This was his last performance. He was the bass player of the band, and it was Arthur Kane who knocked on your door and recruited you to be in the Dolls when the band was being formed. He died just a few weeks after the concert. Did you even know he was sick?
No, and neither did he. He had this incredible life, Arthur, and he was just this really brilliant guy who had this incredible insight into reality that was... It was just one step to the left of probably the most radical people I had ever met at that point. And I don't even mean, politics. I just mean the way he saw things. And they were always spot on. And he was just so brilliant to me. And then he kind of... He had come from this family that was just like hell on earth. And... he got a taste for the booze and went through like a lot of years of just being drunk all the time. And I remember he got to this point where you would just say, "Hi, Arthur," and he would just say, "Woof." His only word became woof. Anyway, he went through all this stuff. I mean, I can't begin to tell you in his life. He fell out a window. He did this. He got hit by a car. He did this. He did that. And then he came out the other side. And he got involved with, the Mormons and became the librarian at the family history office at the Mormon Tabernacle. And he was like this Mormon, but with this really kind of demented outlook on life. So he wasn't, like a proselytizer. But he just was so... wonderful, and he had this very high voice, and he was 6'5" or something.
Let's talk about how he did recruit you for the band. He knocked on your door in your apartment in Manhattan. You were, around 19 or something?
Yeah.
What did he tell you about this new band?
Well, there was a guy who lived in my building who I used to kind of, jam with and strum guitars, and he was this Colombian guy who played bongos, and we used to just sit around and play music. And he knew Billy Mercia, who was the original drummer in the Dolls, and told these guys that who were looking for a singer that I was a singer, and he thought I was a pretty good singer. And so one day Arthur was just at my door with Billy, and Arthur was about 3 feet taller than Billy, and he just said, "I hear you're a singer." And I said, "Yeah," and I invited them in, and we started talking, and they said they had a band, and they were looking for a singer, and I was looking for a band, and we just, really that day, actually, we left my apartment and went like 4 blocks up the street to Johnny Thunder's apartment, where there was some drums and guitars and stuff, and started to play, and we were a band, essentially.
What were some of the things that you knew you didn't want to be about, the kind of music that you thought had dead-ended?
Oh, at that time, there was like these interminable drum solos, and you know what happens when the drum solo stops. It's the worst. Then the bass takes a solo. And and stuff like that, you know? And we just wanted to kind of have some really wham-bam songs. And, I mean, for me, the whole thing was like, if you have to compare it to something like a Little Richard kind of presentation. And I can remember when I was really young and I would go to the Murray the K shows, you know, and I saw Mitch Ryder. And, you know, these shows had 30 acts and everybody would come out and do 2 or 3 minutes. And Mitch Ryder would come out and do a medley of his 3 big hits. He would come out in like kind of like a tuxedo, and within 45 seconds he was half naked and sweating like a pig. And we just wanted to make an explosion, you know, of excitement. So that's what was missing, you know. Rock and roll had become very kind of pedantic and meandering, and it was looking for something, but it was like an actor in search of a play or something, you know.
Now on the album cover of the album, The New York Dolls, you're all dressed in this kind of trashy drag with a lot of eye makeup and lipstick. You're wearing a bouffant wig. I assume it's a wig.
No, it wasn't a wig.
It wasn't a wig?
No.
It teased your hair for it? Because
Well, somebody teased it, right.
And you're wearing what looks like capri pants and high-heeled clogs, an open cardigan revealing your bare chest. And you're staring at yourself in the mirror of a makeup compact.
Right.
And the band's name is written in lipstick.
Right.
For those of us who didn't get to see you on stage, how did that compare with how you actually looked on stage?
Well, that was probably, you know, I mean, I think, you know, to the average civilian, it probably didn't look any different. But to us, we were, like, dressing up a little bit more, make it a little special for the for the record cover, you know. You know, Sylvain was in the rag trade with Billy. They had this little sweater company and called Truth. They sold it to this company called Truth and Soul. They used to make these poor boy sweaters. They had a loom. And through that, they knew a lot of people who actually are very kind of famous designers now, but who were just getting started. And I think it was like Betsy Johnson and these women that she used to work with. They had a store in St. Mark's Place, and they knew a photographer, and they knew a makeup guy, and they knew this and that. You know, we didn't know anything about that. So I think they helped to facilitate that photo session.
What inspired your interest in or willingness to be in a kind of drag for performances? I mean, you mentioned you had been with Charles Ludlam's Ridiculous Theater, and drag was often a part of their performances in theater. So where did you see it fitting into your music?
Well, you know, we were the hotbed of revolution at that time was, you know, St. Mark's Place and Second Avenue. And through that, you know, there were so many artists there and, you know, actors and people who were doing these plays, like the Ridiculous people. And there was, you know, filmmakers and poets and painters. And we were the band of that crowd. I mean, it wasn't like we were the band of even New York City, you know. We were the band, basically, of the East Village, you know. And it wasn't so much like a sexual thing, because, you know, like sexuality refers to like biological aspects. It was more like a gender thing, you know. And gender is like, you know, like the cultural differences that grow up around the biological differences. So instead of like male and female, like gender is really masculine and feminine, right? I think the trick for us at the time was to decide which characteristics were sex and which were gender, you know. And, you know, because there's certain things males do and there's certain things females do. I mean, the universe didn't make 2 sexes for nothing.
Did a lot of people early on assume that you were gay because of the way you dressed in performance or because of the
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it was obviously we weren't gay. I mean, you know, but maybe to some people it was, you know. Uh-huh. You know how some people, I mean, to some people everybody's gay, you know. Like, you could say, like, you could be talking to somebody and go, oh, that Hitler. And they go, gay. You know, so, I mean, some people just think everybody's gay, but I don't know. We were like these kind of street kids from you know, from St. Mark's Place, you know, and we just had this idea that, you know, at the time, masculine meant strong and assertive, feminine meant weak and demure, and this was a time of, like, redefinition of the roles, you know, it was overdue, and it was just part of evolution, I think, you know, and everything kind of transcends and goes beyond what went before, and otherwise, what's the use of doing anything, you know?
David Johansen, co-founder of the 1970s band The New York Dolls, speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. He's the subject of a new documentary co-directed by Martin Scorsese on Showtime titled Personality Crisis, One Night Only. Later, Justin Chang reviews the new film The Eight Mountains. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BritBox, streaming acclaimed original series you won't find anywhere else. With powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, Matthew McFadyen, and more. Streaming at BritBox.com/NPR.
Okay, close your eyes for a second. Now imagine you're on your dream vacation. No work calls to answer, no text messages to respond to, just your suitcase and an opportunity.
The opportunity to just take yourself out of your routine and travel deeper.
How to actually take that dream trip. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
Hey, this is Seth Kelly, producer at Fresh Air.
And this is Molly C.V. Nesper, digital producer at Fresh Air.
We co-write the weekly Fresh Air newsletter.
It's recaps of the week, staff recommendations, gems from the archive, and a glimpse at who's coming on the show soon, all in one place.
It's also a fun peek behind the scenes, what goes into the producing and editing of the interviews, and a chance to meet the people who make Fresh Air.
You can subscribe by going to whyy.org/freshair.
You'll hear from us soon. Now, back to the show.
Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with David Johansen. In 1971, he co-founded the band The New York Dolls. The band never sold many records, but it's become something of a legend, in part for setting the stage for the punk rock movement. Johansen later performed in the persona of lounge singer Buster Poindexter. A new documentary co-directed by Martin Scorsese and David Tedeschi titled Personality Crisis, One Night Only, about David Johansen is currently streaming on Showtime. When Terry spoke with him in 2004, the surviving members of the band had reunited for a festival in England. Their performance was recorded on the CD The Return of the New York Dolls, live from the Royal Festival Hall.
The band was originally used to performing in, like, in Manhattan, in the Village, where people, like, knew the band, the people who came were a part of the same, like, arts subculture that the band was a part of. But when you went on the road in America, did you start playing in places where people weren't kindred spirits in the same way, and they didn't necessarily get what you were doing, they didn't know how to react to it?
Yes and no. I mean, it's very interesting. Like, you know, there were, like, Rust Belt places, you know, like Detroit and Cleveland and places like that. The people would go crazy for us, and they would come to the shows all dressed up, you know, and Chicago. And, you know, we were really well-received in Los Angeles and San Francisco. And we used to play a lot in Florida, you know, Miami. And we used to play in Atlanta and be very well-accepted. And then we used to also, you know, we were friends with Leonard Skinner at the time. We were kind of kindred spirits, and we would go on tours of, like, state fairs and, like, tertiary markets in Missouri together, and we would have a great time, you know. I know in Memphis I got arrested on stage one night for allegedly, you know, it was like the Alice Tully Hall of Memphis. I mean, it was this nice, clean room, and there had been articles in the newspaper that we were coming to Pied Piper all the children to the end of the world or whatever, and we thought it was funny when we read it, but I actually got arrested on stage and
what for?
Went to the Huskow in Memphis, which is... I was dressed like Liza Minnelli at the time, so it wasn't the most relaxing night I ever had.
How do people respond to you in prison?
In jail?
Yeah.
I just, like, hid under these, like, Lysol-smelling, like, army blankets, and then this guy woke up, and he went like, oh, damn, you're David Johansen. And I was like, quiet, quiet, quiet. And then he woke up this bear, and the bear was growling, and I was like, oh, my God, my knees were, like, you know, rattling under these covers. But I got bailed out at, like, dawn.
What were the charges?
Inciting a riot. The cops, you know, the cops wanted to mess the thing up, and they started beating on kids and because they got up and danced. And I stopped the music, and I started explaining to this officer that this child he was abusing may be, you know, the mayor's kid or nephew or something, and his job would be in jeopardy. And then they just threw me in cuffs and dragged me away for inciting a riot. I may not have used the exact same language.
I understand. why did the New York Dolls break up?
Inertia. I don't know. You know, I think we got to a point where I like to think, you know, it was a project that we finished, but there was like factions in the group that were, you know, more interested in drugs than in playing music, and it just kind of became, for me, I mean, I can only speak for myself, you know, it became untenable.
What did you think when you saw the Sex Pistols, the Ramones, your band, the Dolls preceded punk, but it was certainly influential in a lot of punk bands and had the same sensibility in a lot of ways. So when you saw that sensibility just really become so popular, what did you think?
I thought every new idea begins as heresy and winds up as superstition. I think I never saw the Sex Pistols, but I saw the Ramones because they used to rehearse down the hall from me. I forget what if I was in the Dolls or in my next band, but I remember Joey Ramone came to the room I was rehearsing in. You know, they have these buildings in New York with 100 bands playing at once. It's like it would drive a monk insane. And he came by and said that he wanted me to come down the hall and hear his band, and I went down the hall to hear his band, and I probably said, you know, you're a nice guy, why don't you just give up, you know? I told the Talking Heads they should give up. I mean, I would be the worst A&R man in the history of show business because I tell all these bands who were in the beginning that you're a good kid, why don't you get a real job and a house, you know? So, what do I know? I didn't think anything about it being influenced by me or anything like that. It was just probably I had a headache and the music was really loud.
I want to skip ahead to the 80s and 90s when you performed a lot as Buster Poindexter. And, you know, the New York Dolls were so into a kind of pre-punk sensibility and were very high energy and very raw. And, you know, Buster Poindexter is much more of a kind of lounge, more Vegas-oriented kind of persona. You know, instead of in drag on the cover, you know, the Buster Poindexter character is in a tuxedo. And
it's all drag, Terry.
Well, that's the thing. No, but that's exactly the thing.
You know, I mean Birkenstocks are drag.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
Everyone is like, everybody is saying something with their clothes, you know.
So have you always felt like you were standing back and knowing that any kind of drag that you were putting on, any kind of outfit or whatever you were putting on for a performance was always that you always knew it was some kind of drag or another?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the thing with Poindexter is there was a little club, like a saloon, an Irish bar around the corner from my house. I was living in Gramercy Park. It was two blocks from my house, and it was kind of like my watering hole. And they would have bands there like Joe Turner or Charles Brown or Big Maybelle, and they would do residencies there. So they would play like three or four nights a week for a month, say, you know, and there was a room upstairs where they would live. Monday night, the back room was dark. So I had decided I was going to do this little like road barrel house kind of roadhouse show where I could just sing whatever songs I wanted to sing. And I was going to do it for four Mondays. And I went in there and I figured I'd use a pseudonym so people wouldn't be coming in screaming for, you know, Funky Butt Cheek. I went in to do that, and I just picked whatever songs. I had been listening to a lot of Jump Blues at the time, but I also did, you know, like the Seven Deadly Virtues from Camelot and, you know, whatever, just whatever songs I wanted to sing. And by the end of 4 weeks, I started doing weekends, and it just kind of organically built into this. It started out as a three-piece band and wound up as like a 15-piece band. So I think by the time it got to the national awareness, it did have this kind of Vegas-y kind of idea to it. But it started off more kind of like the Louis Prima days in the 50s of Vegas. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right, right. Well, that image was encouraged, like on the cover of the Buster Poindexter album, you're drinking a martini,
right?
In a tuxedo, right, with your pinky ring.
And then I was back on. See, I was walking to work. I was making a nice living, and then we had a hit, and you know, we all went to hell because we had to go back on the road.
Right. Well, I want to play something from the Buster Poindexter era, and
don't play Hot, Hot, Hot.
No, I wasn't going to. I was going to play.
Thank God.
Were you really tired of it?
It's the bane of my life.
I was going to play Bad Boy.
Okay.
Tell me why you recorded this. This is a cover.
Well, I don't know. It's just a good song. It was written by Lil Armstrong. And I always liked it ever since I was a kid.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's hear it. This is from the Buster Poindexter album. Bad Boy from David Johansen's album Buster Poindexter. David Johansen is my guest, and his first band, the New York Dolls, has a reunion concert that was just released on CD and DVD. It seems to me that you've had so many different characters you've inhabited as a performer, and I'm wondering how much you think your career as an actor has come into play in your career as a musician, you know, because before you were even in the New York Dolls, you were with the Ridiculous Theater Company in New York, and over the years you've been in, you know, a lot of movies as well.
Yeah, I guess, you know, there's a lot of a kind of acting involved. I have this friend, Elliot Murphy, who's a singer. He lives in Paris now. And I remember when I started doing Buster Poindexter, he used to say to me, David, you know, Buster Poindexter is so much more like you than David Johansen is, you know, if you get what I'm saying. In other words, with Buster, I really kind of went on stage and really didn't edit myself and just kind of said whatever came to my mind and didn't have many filters. Whereas prior to that, in the period of my, I guess you would call it solo career, although, you know, you're always in a band, so it's never really a solo career. But I had the David Johansen group or band or whatever it was called, and we used to open for a lot of bands and hockey rinks, you know, and you kind of go out there. At that point, I was going out there and kind of presenting this, what I thought, like, ideal picture of myself, you know what I mean? Just this pleasant fellow, you know? Whereas Buster was really kind of more warts and all, you know? And I think by doing that, it helped me to be myself more, you know, whereas so now when I go on stage, I'm not like biting my nails like, oh, what am I gonna do, what are we, how am I gonna be, blah blah blah. I just don't even think about it because I'm just gonna go out there and essentially be whoever I am at that moment, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you once said back in the Buster Poindexter era, Buster can have this great life in the public eye and take the rap for everything, and then David can go home.
Exactly. You know, it's funny because my mother, when Buster came out, she said, you know, this is the most genius idea you've ever come up with. This is great. And I think that was her idea that, you know, Buster can take the rap, and politicians should do it.
Now, you have a show on Sirius, which is one of the satellite radio stations.
Oh, yeah.
Who are you as a DJ? Are you just yourself, or do you have a...
I have a show called The Mansion of Fun.
Uh-huh.
And I'm kind of like Sri Rama Poindexter Johansson. And I'm very taken with Sri Ramakrishna lately because I read a biography of his and thought, man, that guy knew how to live. And he called the planet the Mansion of Fun. So I named my show after that. And I play a really diverse bunch of music. You know, I play salsa, opera, blues, rock and roll, you know, you name it. I play a lot of Nino Rota music. I play, you know, whatever tickles my fancy. So it's really completely free form, and I speak a lot of kind of Ken Wilber type forward thinking philosophy.
Well, David Johansson, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
David Johansson, co-founder of the 1970s band The New York Dolls, speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. He's the subject of a new documentary co-directed by Martin Scorsese on Showtime titled Personality Crisis, One Night Only. Here's David Johansson performing in his lounge lizard persona, Buster Poindexter, from the new documentary.
Tonight I'm going to do songs that I wrote or co-wrote, I guess from when I was a teenager, all the way up to now. And the one thing I could say, the unifying thing of my existence, is that there's always been plenty of music.
Oh, nice. Very nice.
Great sadness today. I don't wanna shush it or shoo it away. It belongs to the whole world, the boys and girls. It ain't just mine. Like joy and love, it's always there. I don't know how I tune in or why that I care, but I can't pretend it don't feel like the end. And everything is fine. I feel exiled from the divine. Me and these sad friends of mine, we've just waiting down here, drinking beer and losing time. Well, I hear plenty of music. I see superfluous beauty everywhere. Why should I care? What does it matter to me?
Yeah, yeah. All right.
The myth of life. Song. Yeah.
Coming up, Justin Chang reviews the new film, The Eight Mountains. This is Fresh Air.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor, Lisa, in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, which believes plants and gardening are for everyone. With over 25 years of developing, trialing, and testing some of the most recognized flowering shrubs and evergreens on the market, Proven Winners Color Choice makes it easy to transform dull landscapes into colorful, vital spaces for work and play. Available in the distinctive white containers at garden centers nationwide, or learn more at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR.
This message comes from Jackson. Let's face it, retirement planning can be confusing. At Jackson, we're working to make retirement clear for everyone, starting with you. Our easy-to-understand resources and user-friendly digital tools help simplify your entire experience. You can have confidence in your retirement with clarity from Jackson. Seek the clarity you deserve at Jackson.com. Jackson is short for Jackson Financial Incorporated, Jackson National Life Insurance Company, Lansing, Michigan, and Jackson National Life Insurance Company of New York, Purchase, New York.
Our film critic Justin Chang says The Eight Mountains is the most visually stunning movie in theaters right now, and one of the most moving. Winner of the jury prize at last year's Cannes Film Festival, it's an adaptation of Paolo Cognetti's best-selling novel about a decades-long friendship between two men who first meet as boys in the Italian Alps. Here's Justin's review.
Over the past several months, I've seen a few unusually heartfelt movies about male friendship. A subject that Hollywood likes to milk for laughs, but rarely treats with the sincerity and sensitivity it deserves. So it's been refreshing to encounter films that have recently bucked the trend, like Armageddon Time and the Oscar-nominated Close. The best of the bunch is the new Italian-language drama The Eight Mountains, which was written and directed by the Belgian filmmakers Felix von Groningen and Charlotte van der Meersch. Adapted from Paolo Cognetti's 2016 debut novel, it tells the story of two young boys who meet in the Italian Alps and forge a life-changing bond. The mountain scenery is spectacular. See this one in a theater if you can. But it's the richness of the emotional journey that stays with you. The story is narrated by Pietro, a young boy from the city of Turin who's spending a summer in the Alps with his parents. It's there that he meets another boy about the same age, named Bruno, who lives on a small farm nearby. They become fast friends, and the mountain, with its scenic lakes and lush valleys, makes for a stunning open playground. The movie captures the rambunctious, rough-and-tumble joy of their time together, which is innocent and perfect and, of course, can't last. Summer ends, Pietro returns to Turin, and Bruno remains behind in the mountains. Apart from one brief meeting as teenagers, they don't really see each other again until decades later, when they're fully grown men. Pietro is now played by the terrific Italian star Luca Marinelli, and Bruno by the quietly charismatic Alessandro Borghi. Their long overdue reunion is set in motion by the untimely death of Pietro's father. It's here that The Eight Mountains soars to life as an achingly bittersweet drama about two pals returning to the place where they first met years earlier and making up for all their time apart. I was often reminded of Brokeback Mountain. Even if Pietro and Bruno's love story is, as far as we can tell, a platonic one, they both seek refuge in nature and each other from their frustrations and disappointments. Pietro is in for some tough revelations. He learns that his dad, from whom he was estranged, had grown close to Bruno and had even become a kind of surrogate father figure. But while Pietro feels some jealousy and regret, he doesn't resent Bruno for it. If anything, it brings them closer together and even allows Pietro to make peace with a parent he never understood. Before long, the two decide to build a cabin in the mountains, something Pietro's father had dreamed of doing himself. It's hard work, but Bruno is a skilled carpenter, and Pietro learns fast. They try to meet back at the house every summer. In the meantime, Bruno becomes a farmer and cheesemaker like his ancestors before him. He falls in love with a woman and has a daughter. Pietro becomes a writer and also falls in love with a woman whom he meets while traveling in Nepal. Even so, both men remain strangely unfulfilled. And one of the insights of the Eight Mountains is that everyone, whether they come from town or country, experiences unhappiness in their own unique way. Pietro, educated and restless, doesn't quite know who he is. He flits from one adventure to the next, unsure of where or how to settle down. Bruno, hardy and stubborn, has the opposite problem. He can't envision a life for himself away from these mountains, even when his bills begin to mount and the farm begins to fail. This is the first film directed by van der Meersch, a longtime actor. Her co-director and partner, Van Groningen, has made a number of earlier features, including the romantic tragedy The Broken Circle Breakdown and Beautiful Boy, an addiction drama starring Timothy Chalamet. He loves tormented characters and big, angsty emotions. But while The Eight Mountains churns with feeling, I came away admiring its subtlety and complexity, and yes, its majesty. It isn't just the movie's visual grandeur that wows you. It's the scale of it, the way it merges the epic and the intimate. At times, the camera will pull back and show us the characters from a distance, dwarfed by the sheer magnificence of their surroundings, as if to suggest how small we all are in the scheme of things. But then it will cut to Pietro and Bruno, letting their faces and bodies fill the screen, and their lives suddenly don't seem so insignificant. Their love story is beautiful and unforgettable.
Justin Chang is the film critic at the LA Times. On Monday's show, journalist James Risen tells the story of Senator Frank Church, who exposed crimes and cover-ups of the CIA and FBI nearly 50 years ago. Risen says the Church hearings, which revealed CIA assassination plots, led to congressional oversight of the intelligence agencies. Risen's book is The Last Honest Man. I hope you can join us. By the way, to keep up with what's on the show and get highlights of our interviews, follow us on Instagram at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shorrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman, Julian Hertzfeld, and Al Banks. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Susan Yakundi. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. The Capital One Venture X business card earns unlimited double miles on every purchase. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/VentureXBusiness.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Chevron, taking action to keep methane in the pipe. They've trialed advanced detection technologies and are committed to evolving facility designs and operating practices. That's energy in progress. More at Chevron.com/methane.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.